Welcome back to Jim Bohannon Show as we take a look at the latest flurry of activity on gun control. And the minute, of course, that the Democrats won control of the House back in November, we knew this was coming. It was not probably going to become law because of the fact that Republicans actually strengthened their thin hold on the Senate. So there'll be a lot of an activity flurry going on, but probably not much in the way of actual change. Now, tell me a bit more, if you would, John Lott, about the notion of lending your gun to someone, landing you in prison.
Right. Well, these laws deal with the private transfer of guns, and they generally say you have to go and have a background check done before you can go and lend somebody your gun. So, but there are a couple exceptions, like if you're going to be at a shooting range and you're lending a gun to somebody, you're allowed to do it while you're there. But there are other things that you may think are reasonable, but will land you in jail. And one of the examples is, let's say a woman's being stalked. She calls you up. She's a friend of yours. You know she's trained. She knows how to use a gun. She doesn't own one, though. And she's being stalked, and she calls you up. Well, if you lend her your gun, unless you're there physically with her when you're lending it to her, you'd be committing a crime. And now, there's an exception. You're allowed to lend it to her while she's in imminent danger of being killed or physical harm.
She's in imminent danger. Handing somebody a gun would be a good way to get you shot.
Right. Well, you're exactly on point there. It's a legal term of art, and it's saying that she has to be directly in danger at that very moment. She has to be facing the guy. You might as well use it yourself to brandish it and cause him to leave the scene. And let's say he leaves. Well, then you'd have to take the gun back from her, even though you know that the guy would be coming back at some future date. I mean, I guess you could hang around there with her the entire time, but you wouldn't be able to just lend her the gun. And there's lots of other situations. My kids have gone through scouting. If I were to lend the troop a shotgun when they go and do their annual shooting trip for their merit badges, unless I went with the troop for the shooting range, it would be a crime that would be committed at that time. And so, you know, it's just, you kind of wonder, I mean, what's the woman supposed to do? If it's a Saturday night and she's been threatened, the guy came in by, banged on the door, but left, but she was afraid he was going to come back later on. And she wanted to borrow a gun for a few days until she was able to get to a store to be able to go and buy one herself. One of the pieces of legislation here would put delays on people's ability to go and buy a gun quickly also, so it may be a few days after that. So what happens to her? Is she, you know, what is she supposed to do at that point if a friend can't even temporarily lend her a gun?
1-866-50-JIMBO, our number, 1-866-505-4626, with our guest, Dr. John Lott. He is the author of a number of books. His latest, The War on Guns, Arming Yourself Against Gun Control Lies from Regnery, and also the book also published by Regnery, More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws from University of Chicago Press, I might add that one. Andy calls in from Butler, Pennsylvania on the Bohannon Show. Good evening, Andy.
Good evening, Mr. Bohannon, and good evening to your guest.
Hello.
My question maybe is simple or oversimplified, but what I would like to know is where exactly does the Constitution give Congress the right to write any regulations about guns after the Second Amendment was passed? I mean, if you're going to say the Commerce Clause does, well, then didn't the Second Amendment change that, being as the Constitution was written and verified on one date, and then the amendment comes after, and the amendment changes the original Constitution? Example, originally in the Constitution, slavery was allowed. The 13th Amendment ended slavery. So my point would be, originally in the Constitution, you could write any gun law you wanted, but after the Second Amendment said, shall not be infringed, no longer could that happen.
All right, your thoughts about that. That, of course, obviously what Andy brings up goes right down to the wording of the Second Amendment, so that everybody's on the same page here. I'll read it and then let John respond. The Second Amendment to the Constitution reads, and of course it is that wording that has always created so much discussion, "A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed." Okay, John?
Right. Well, you know, there's a number of parts of the Constitution that, at least to lay readers, seem pretty clear. So the First Amendment says, Congress shall pass no law, you know, abridging freedom of speech and assembly and other things that are in there. And the Second Amendment, as you say, shall not infringe. You know, when I've been in law schools, taught in law schools, I'd often ask people, I say, so if for the First Amendment, when they're talking about freedom of speech, what would they have actually had to write if they really meant Congress shall pass no law? Should they had to say Congress shall never, ever, 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 ever pass such a law? Or, you know, how many no's did they have to put in there in order to make it clear? And what the courts have done over time is, and I think they've done this simply because they like to be relevant and be part of all these discussions and essentially have more power, is they've put in kind of gray areas and vagueness into what seem like pretty clear languages, because then people have to go to the courts to have things decided. So you take something like campaign finance laws. You think if the First Amendment meant to protect anything, it was surely political speech that was there. But what the courts have decided is that they have these so-called balancing tests, where they say, well, maybe there's good reasons that you have for restricting this. And they'll say in the case of campaign spending, there's the appearance of corruption.
All right. Now, we're coming up on a break that doesn't move here, so I want you to continue that thought, and we'll take more calls in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're talking with Dr. John Lott. He is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org. And you had some thoughts you were offering us, John, if you want to finish those up, and then we'll take some more calls.
Sure. So the caller had asked, you know, there are parts of the Constitution that seem pretty clear. You know, First Amendment, Congress shall pass no laws. The Second Amendment shall not infringe. And what's happened is that the courts have introduced these so-called balancing tests, where they say, well, there are exceptions, and we can judge, and you have to come to us to judge whether or not the reasons that are offered by Congress for abridging those restrictions are good reasons. And so, you know, the court's given a lot more power in policy areas by kind of, you know, ignoring the exact meaning of the words that are there and leaving it up to themselves to decide whether or not, you know, the reasons that Congress gives for kind of enacting a law that you think would have been forbidden by the Bill of Rights or something else has a good enough reason for doing so.
And so I guess it would be a stretch to imagine the courts ruling that the courts have this wrong.
Yeah, courts aren't likely to take away their own power.
Yeah.
Like that.
Robert in Enterprise, Alabama, is up next with our guest, John Lott of crimeresearch.org. Good evening, Robert.
Good evening, sir. Hey, I had a question about the individual was talking about if you loaned your weapon, but what if you gifted your weapon to the individual for the time, you know, if you have gifted the weapon in a timely manner, instead of having them, you know, if you knew they were legal to possess a weapon.
All right.
Yeah.
Does the word gift, which of course would imply a formal transfer, does that get around this or run into another problem?
No, doesn't get around it. Essentially, if you give a gun, whether it's, you know, classified as a loan or classified as a gift or classified as a sale. If you transfer a gun in any of those ways to somebody else, you'd have to have a background check done before you can do it, even if it's under the understanding that, you know, you're giving it to them and they have a kind of a secret promise to give it back to you after a couple days. It doesn't really matter. You have to have the, in fact, if they have to give it back, then there'd have to be another background check. If you were to gift it to them, there'd be a background check for you to give it to them, and you pay your money for that, and then when they gave it back to you, there'd have to be another background check there, and you'd have to pay the fees all over again.
1-866-50-JIMBO is our number as we go to Dan in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Good evening, Dan.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Lott.
Good morning.
I guess that to me, it's sort of a sneaky way of finding out who all has the guns. And I mean, you look back in history and all the countries that have banned guns, and they've all started with a registry, so the government knows who has the guns. So when it comes time to take them, they know who to go at first. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think you're on to something there. I mean, there's several issues. There's several things that could easily be fixed with these laws, these proposals, that would get them passed almost instantly. You're having your finger on one of the things, and that is, I mean, the bill technically says that no registry will be allowed with the registrations, because the concern is that every person who buys a gun, as well as any transfer that occurs, they'll have a list of that. When you buy it from a dealer, the dealer's required to go and keep that information. And at some point in the future, you know, 5 years down the line, 6 years down the line, let's say the Democrats have taken control not just of Congress but of the presidency at that time, they could go and pass a change in the law that says, all that information that you've collected on all those transfers and sales, well, you know, you've already have it digitized. Just send the computer files to the federal government, and the federal government has kind of an instant national registry for everybody. And they could do, you know, if they wanted to, the type of thing you're talking about. Indeed, we've seen a number of states, from New York to California to Chicago to other places, that have used registration lists in the United States. It's just not something that's happened in foreign countries to do it. So one thing you could say in order to alleviate that concern is to say, well, you keep the registration information for a year or 2 years or some set period of time, and then you, just like the federal government, when it does a background check, it's technically only supposed to keep that information for 24 hours. There have been some issues, like the Obama administration was keeping the information for a couple years in some cases without destroying it. And but, you know, that's one thing. The other two things that I think that they could fix, that they could get these bills instantly passed with votes from all the Republicans, would be, one, who pays for this? We've mentioned the cost. You know, as an economist, I would say the people who benefit from a service from the government should be the ones who pay for it. And if you believe that these background checks reduce crime, and I don't, but if you do believe that, then you believe it reduces crime for everybody, not just the individual who's buying the gun. In fact, if anything, you know, they're very law-abiding. They're going out of their way to make sure that there's a background check when they're transferring the gun that they have. Well, pay for it out of general revenue. If everybody benefits, then everybody should pay for it, not the full freight being borne on the very law-abiding individual who is going out of their way to obey the law. In fact, if anything, you shouldn't penalize them. You want to encourage them to go and do these background checks. So why essentially tax them for doing the thing that you want them to go and do? The second issue that you could have is that we've been hearing this week in the debates that there are 3.5 million dangerous or prohibited people that have been stopped from buying guns or obtaining guns because of background checks. And that's simply false. What they should say is that there have been 3.5 million initial denials, And virtually all of those, something around 99% of them, are mistakes. It's one thing to stop a felon from buying a gun. It's another thing to stop somebody simply because they have a name similar to a felon. And they could easily fix that. All they have to do is have the federal government have to meet the same rules for background checks that we require companies when they do background checks on employees, that the federal government mandates that companies have to do, and that is use all the exact information. You think when you buy a gun, you're filling out the 4473, you're giving your name, your Social Security number, your address, your race, your eye color, your birthday. You think they're using all that information, but what they use is roughly phonetically similar names, and they use similar birthdays. And the problem is that that primarily harms minorities. People have names similar to others in their racial groups. Hispanics have names similar to other Hispanics. Blacks have names similar to other blacks. 30% of black males are legally prohibited from owning a gun because of past criminal history. Well, whose names are their names most likely to be confused with? Other law-abiding good black males. So you could fix all these things and get it through quickly. It just shows that the issue isn't having background checks. The issue is how the laws do it. So you could say, who pays for it? Fix it so you don't make these 3.5 million mistakes and get the wrong person banned from having a gun. And the other thing is keeping the records for some specified period of time before they can be done away with. And if you agree to all three of these things, I can't really think of any objection that people would raise to having these universal background checks. And I don't really understand. I've for 20 years, I've been talking to gun control advocates and telling them, if your goal is really these background checks, I can tell you how to get it passed. But they fight against these things. You go and say, pay for these things out of general revenue, they will go nuts. I mean, it's like holding a cross to a vampire. And I can give you examples. Like in Colorado a few years ago when they're passing their universal background check system, I got calls from state legislators asking me what amendment I would put up. And my suggestion was to put up an amendment that would exempt people below the poverty level from having to pay the new state tax on gun transfers. With the exception of two pro-gun Democrats in the state house, every other Democrat voted against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay that tax. How many taxes can you think of where Democrats will fight tooth and nail against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay?
Yeah, not a great many. We're going to take a break and come back with more calls for our guest, Dr. John Lott from crimeresearch.org, back in a moment. Welcome back to Jim Bohannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, as we take a call from Steve in Pittsburgh for our guest, Dr. John Lott. Hello, Steve.
Hello. What happens if you've got a couple, whether it be married or unmarried, and one of the couples or married people have multiple felonies? Is the gun allowed to be in the possession of them if they're in the same dwelling where one is not allowed to have firearms?
I can recall a great line that that Gordon Liddy used to make on his talk show, and that was that he, as a convicted felon, is not allowed to own guns, but his wife owns 27, and she keeps them under the bed. So, John Lott, I'll let you respond in that context.
Right. Well, it depends on where you're at. And generally, what Jim is referring to is what the federal law is on this. But you have a number of states which say that if you have a felon in the household there, it basically bans anybody from being able to go and have a gun there in the household. So, I mean, there are a number of states you can probably guess what some of them are, California, New York, et cetera, where you'd be banned from having them if a felon is in residence.
All right. There you go. There's your answer, Steve. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yes, it does, and I thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Appreciate your call and your listenership as we go to Doc in Wilmington, Delaware. Hello, Doc.
Thank you for taking my call, as sure. always, Mr. Boyan.
Mm-hmm.
Have a slight cold, so please forgive me. Dr. Lott, what do you think the chances are in a second Trump term, my emphasis, of us having a totally pro-Second Amendment Supreme Court that can go around Justice Roberts if he is a swing vote? And will any justices be replaced? And will this current court, and will Justice Roberts side with us if there are any gun cases in this current court? We're in my emphasis, sir, and your long-standing study of the issue, the Second Amendment where Trump, no pun intended, the Tenth Amendment, and no state would be able to make a restrictive law against firearms, particularly concealed carry, magazine capacity, or semi-automatic weapons. Your thoughts, sir?
Right. Well, thanks. There's a case coming up already this session from New York City. You have to have a license to own a gun in New York City, but you're not allowed to transport it basically any place outside your house other than to a few well-defined shooting ranges. That's the only place you can transport the gun between. You can't, if you have a second residence in another place in New York, you can't take it there. You can't take it to your business, unless you have a carry license, which is very difficult. You have to be very politically connected and in order to go and get that. That extreme limitation on where you can go and transfer, can you take it to another residence that you have, is being taken to the Supreme Court. And so, something like that, I think, will get struck down, and I think Roberts will be likely to do it. But in order to kind of go past those extreme cases, you're probably right, you're going to have some change in the Supreme Court, and that would have to take place during a second Trump term. And you have somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's 85 right now. I suppose it's possible she could make it till 90, but it's unlikely that she would stay on the court. I mean, we've had a number of cases in the past where people almost comatose have stayed on the court kind of well past their expiration date. And, that could happen again in this case. It's just at some point people have to make a decision on whether it gets too embarrassing for them to be able to participate.
Stay with us. More calls to come at 1-866-50-JIMBO. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hanna Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-5426-26, as we talk with Dr. John Lott at crimeresearch.org about proposed gun control legislation, and in fact, two bills that have already passed the House and face almost certain death in the Senate, but the battle is joined. And incidentally, if you're on the line, John has graciously agreed to extend into the next hour, so we will get to your call. Starting with Michael in Hudson, New Hampshire. Good evening, Michael.
Hey, John. Anyway, I think, they're doing this incrementally, and that's what they love to do, small steps at a time instead of sweeping legislation, okay? And also,
by this, you mean what? Banning guns, or what exactly?
Well, laws like this, like not being able to, sell a gun to your buddy or something like that. They just do a little one here, a little one there, take a little piece here, a little piece there, until they get the whole pie. I think that's what they like to do, and they like to do it in our state too. And I live in New Hampshire, and also, if you noticed, John, on the form 4473. It's rather racist, I think, because they ask you all these ethnic questions. Are you black? Are you white? Now, if you did this in any other form, you'd be branded as a racist or something like that. So what are your thoughts on that?
All right. And I take it that form to which Michael refers is a gun control form, John?
Well, it's the form that you have to fill out whenever you go and buy a gun. The dealer will give it to you, or even now, if you transfer a gun in the states that have those types of background check rules, then you have to fill it out. And people have seen these types of forms. It asks a lot of descriptive information about yourself, and then it asks you questions. You know, do you have a felony? Do you have a certain type of misdemeanors? Have you been dishonorably discharged? Do you use drugs? Are you a drug addict? Those types of questions. It's kind of, you know, if you fill those out improperly, you lie, you say you're not a felon, then it's perjury that's there. And, of course, that's also what they're checking when they go and do the background check. I agree generally with what the caller is saying, and that is you have, quote, reasonable gun control laws that they're trying to pass, but they make it more costly, more difficult for people to be able to go and obtain guns. I worry about the cost of this, and particularly who they're stopping. I mean, we've talked about the cost for background checks. I mean, everybody wants to stop criminals from getting guns. The question is, who should pay for it? Should it be everybody if everybody benefits? But gun control advocates, as we mentioned before, will fight against you saying, well, then pay for it out of general revenue. A lot of these things, they could get what they want, but get it done in a way that's not going to prevent law-abiding individuals from getting guns. Get rid of the mistakes and the background checks for them. As far as the racist angle that he's bringing up, you know, government collects information on race lots of times. This was a change that was done by the Obama administration in 2010. I'd actually like to use that information in one sense because I believe very strongly that there's a lot of evidence that it's particularly, as we talked about before, minorities who are being disproportionately stopped from buying guns and also disproportionately stopped for false positives, these false reasons. And you could see that if they went back to putting out these annual reports that they used to have, the Obama administration's.
Well, we're coming up on a break here, but we'll continue some more of your thoughts. And again, the calls who are online, we'll continue our discussion in just a few minutes with John Lott from crimeresearch.org. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One. Hi there, good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-5426. Online, find us at jimbohannonshow.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Jimbo Talks. We're talking with Dr. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, their website, crimeresearch.org, about gun law news, including two bills passed by the House, headed to likely defeat in the Senate, and a few other gun issues that exist as well. David in San Francisco calls in. Hello, David.
Yes, how are you, Jim? Your guest, the thing that bugs me about this, the Constitution is pretty clear about a well-regulated militia. And gun laws are obviously a part of that, the idea that we want to prevent coups. And, everything from the Whiskey Rebellion in, shortly after 1776.
Well, the Whiskey Rebellion, I guess, was in the 1790s, something like that. Yeah,
right.
The government was new. Yeah.
Right. And so the idea of a well-regulated militia is something entirely different than, endless. What are we up to? Something like 400 different school shootings since Trump has come into office?
How many we've had. But anyway, we've had a number of such shootings. And so
it's coups. People are intending to do coups. And to ignore
to do coup, you want to make coups or prevent coups? I'm not sure what you're saying about coups.
Well, when you start looking, the night before Charlottesville, the torchlight parade and talking or chanting a Nazi slogan about, was it land and prosperity or something like that?
Which has nothing whatsoever to do with the whole issue that we're discussing here, David. As a matter of fact, you can look at the number of people who were shot in Charlottesville. That would be zero. Anyway, John, go ahead.
Not really sure where to start on that. The, I mean, we haven't had that many school shootings. I mean, one could say one.
We certainly haven't had 400 in the Trump administration that I've heard of.
Right. Yeah. Look, I mean, you look at things from Bloomberg's Everytown. They've put out numbers that maybe over the last couple decades there may be 400 or so that they claim. But there have been a number of fact checks out there saying that they've included cases that don't even involve shooting on the campuses, that you know, may occur a suicide at 2 a.m. in the morning where somebody's just pulled into the parking lot, may include, you know, gang fights at 11 p.m. at night or something like that, that are on the street nearby the school. So, I mean, when you're talking about actual school shootings, you're talking about a much, much smaller number, particularly the types of mass public school shootings. We've seen a couple that I can think of. You have the one in, obviously, Parkland, and you had the one in Santa Fe, Texas. But those types of kind of mass school shootings under the Trump administration, those are the only two that come quickly to mind here. Yeah. I may have missed one. But the, you know, fortunately, they're not as often as the caller is saying.
No.
You know, often there's a measure of the number of mass shootings. What people need to understand is there's a big difference between mass shootings and mass public shootings. I'm talking about generally, not just at schools. And the FBI defines them differently. Mass shootings would be all shootings with four or more people are killed, or mass public shootings would be ones that occur in public, not part of some other type of crime. And the distinction between those is largely gang fights over things like drug turf. The mass public shootings are the ones that get our attention, where somebody's going out there not as part of some other crime, but just to go and kill people for the sake of killing them. And fortunately, both of those are a lot rarer than people think, but the second one in particular.
Let's talk to Mike in Cumberland, Maryland on the Jim Bohannon Show. Hello, Mike, and good evening.
Hello. John, thank you for all you do in trying to preserve my Second Amendment rights. And Jim, here you go again, keeping me up past my bedtime.
Well, that's our job here.
Yeah,
you get paid the big bucks to do that.
That's right.
You know, for the life of me, I don't understand how these leftists can get away with requiring us to have a license before we can exercise a constitutional right. Could you imagine New York City telling its citizens, before you can write an op-ed, before you can post anything online, you have to run it through us. You have to have a license first, and we have to approve it. Now, could you imagine anything like that happening?
John?
I just don't understand how they get away with requiring us to have a license to exercise a constitutional right. Here in Maryland, where mm-hmm. I'm stuck at the time, you have to have a handgun qualification license in order to buy a handgun. And to obtain that license, not once do you ever have to see a handgun, touch a handgun, or operate a handgun. It's all about taking your money and incrementally taking your rights.
And about 5 hours of your time, as I can vouch for, as I bought my Smith & Wesson 357 in the state of Maryland and spent an entire morning filling out the forms. Your response to Mike in Cumberland, Maryland, John?
Right. Well, I mean, this gets a little bit back to a question that we had earlier about, you know, what does the Second Amendment mean? What does shall not infringe mean? And what the courts have generally adopted is what they call balancing tests, that if there's a sufficient, you know, often safety-type regulation, then they could say, well, we think that justifies the infringement that might be there. And so you're going to have a pretty big change on the Supreme Court before they would have kind of the plain meaning type of reading of the Second Amendment or the First or other parts of the Constitution. I think you're talking about the handgun license, for example. I fear that the main reason why they have that and the cost of going through the process to get the license and the course and stuff is just to make it costly for people to be able to get it. They can't go and ban guns directly, and so they impose different costs on you for doing it as a way of discouraging people. And my concern is that it's particularly poorer individuals who are the ones who are going to be most discouraged from doing it, the very people that my research finds benefit the most from having a gun for protection are the very people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime.
Thank you for your call, Mike. And we go to Ted in the Jamestown, New York. Hello, Ted.
Hi, Jim.
Mr. Hi.
Lott.
Mm-hmm.
I want to start this by saying in my area,